side as the two boats swept by with their headlamps shining. After they passed, Gray continued his swim across the park, hidden beneath the casket. He didn't know if this mode of transportation was good luck or a bad omen. Still, he forged on, slowly floating his way toward the boat. Hopefully, the patrol would be gone once he got there. After another half minute of silence, Gray risked ducking back outside to gauge his trajectory across the park. As his head cleared the water, a thunderous scream jerked him around. He stared back toward the Bourge Abadi. The trio of boats faced the entrance. From the center one, a streak of smoke cut through the blood-tinged night and slammed into the multi-story glass facade. The explosion of a rocket-propelled grenade shattered into the lobby. Sheets of glass fell from above like 100 shimmering guillotines, opening a wide chasm. A pair of the engines whined into a roar, and two of the boats swept through that gap and into the dark lobby. Once they were inside, another flare burst like a red sun. Gray hoped the others had taken cover and that the patrol would only make a cursory pass before exiting the tower. In the meantime, he had his own mission. Before he could turn away, an eerie vibration shuddered through the water. The surface of the lake trembled. With a low groan, the world began plunging down all around them. Towers sank faster, floor by floor. The last of the treetops vanished under the waves. Trapped air bubbled out everywhere, the last drowning gasp of utopia. Across the park, the blasted hole in the facade of the Bourge Abadi had shrunk to a lowering archway as the tower submerged. A single boat came racing through, the occupants ducking under the fangs of broken glass. The second boat got trapped inside, circling futilely behind the glass as the hole closed. The patrols on the outside tried to fire another rocket, but by the time they readied a shot, the entire lobby had sunk away. Gray swung around, taking advantage of the distraction, knowing the crews would be focused on their trapped companions. The Hummer and jet boat were gone, vanished fully underwater. Reaching where they had sunk, he took a huge breath, kicked his legs over his head, and dove down through the fiery surface waters. Far below stretched only darkness. Gray strained for those black depths. 4:33 a.m. Seishan fought for more height. Below, a rising flood chased her and the others, swallowing the spiraling stairs beneath them. But that wasn't all. A few floors down, dark shadows pounded their way up, their panicked flight lit by the shine of a few emergency bulbs. The trapped crew of the patrol boat sought the same escape they did, running for higher ground, staying ahead of the cresting water. Seishan wanted to put three floors between her team and the water table before abandoning the stairs and trying to reach the far windows on one of these levels. But she had another problem. She was thoroughly turned around. With the power out, the tower levels had stopped rotating and settled into a haphazard corkscrew. Floors stuck out in all directions. On top of that, the dizzying spiral of the staircase left her disoriented. She no longer had any idea which side of the building she was supposed to meet Gray. A gunshot echoed from below. She scowled at the source, the fleeing patrol. First, what did the bastards think they could hit? And second, fuck you very much. But if they wanted to play that game, she wouldn't mind eliminating a few worries. Kowalski! Do it! Anything you say! He still lugged Amanda over one shoulder, but he reached to a pocket as he ran. He let the pellets he collected dribble between his fingers, falling away like a trail of breadcrumbs onto the steps. She watched between her toes and waited until the shadows below reached the littered section of stairs. Now! She yelled. Kowalski pressed his transceiver, igniting the last of his C4 pellets. The blast took out the point man, and the survivors retreated from the shattered gap in the glass staircase. They were trapped with no other way up. Sorry, fellas. You started this war. She continued her maddening flight up the steps. After a few more turns, she heard screams rise from below. She used their cries to judge the distance to that drowning flood. Either the waters were rising faster, or their pace was slowing. Whichever the case, they were losing this foot race. "Next level," she shouted to Tucker. "Take that one. Find the shortest path to the outer windows." Reaching that floor, Seishan raced after the handler and his dog, a silent prayer on her lips. Tucker turned into a long hall. "Over here," he yelled. "A balcony at the end." "Shoot out the lock," Seishan hollered back. They needed every second. She sprinted, trailed by Kowalski. To the man's credit, he kept up, even burdened by Amanda's weight. He was a veritable draft horse. Gunshots blasted ahead. She reached Tucker and Kane as the man hauled open the sliding glass door. A wide balcony beckoned. They all fled out onto it. Seishan moved to the rail. The rising water churned one floor down. If they had to jump, she feared two things. If they didn't leap far enough, the undertow caused by the plunging tower would drag them all down. And even if they cleared that danger, these rough seas had sharks, and not only the ones with fins. A patrol boat drifted to the right, not far from the park. They would never be able to swim fast enough to escape it, and their splashes would likely draw the crew's attention. Seishan searched the drowning city. "Where are you, Gray?"
4:35 a.m.
"Come on. Come on."
Running out of air, Gray blindly sawed at the nylon strap with his knife. It had taken him too long to find the boat as it hung in the dark depths, still tethered to the trailer. The positive buoyancy of the vessel had locked the tie-downs tight. There was no one clipping them from their bolts. He'd already cut the straps at the bow. Once free, the boat's nose rose toward the surface, hanging vertical, still anchored at the stern. Keeping one hand on the transom, he worked at that rear strap of the tie-down. Pressure built in his ears as the island sank deeper, dragging him and the boat farther underwater. As his air began to give out, he sawed frantically.
"Stubborn piece of—"
A light flared overhead, brightening the waters. A dark shadow idled into view on the surface, limned against the glow of its own lamps and accompanied by the slow putter of its engines. Gray waited, despite the screaming burn in his lungs. Once the shadow was directly overhead, Gray cut through the last of the tie-downs. Freed, the jet boat torpedoed upward, becoming a buoyancy-propelled battering ram. 4:36 a.m. Seishan waited, despite the screaming burn in his lungs. Once the shadow was directly overhead, Gray cut through the last of the tie-downs. Freed, the jet boat torpedoed upward, becoming a buoyancy-propelled battering ram. 4:36 a.m. Seishan watched the speedboat drift closer, coming within 50 yards of the tower. One of the crew shouted, another pointed a rifle. Her team had been spotted. A blast echoed over the water, the round ricocheted off the balcony railing. Seishan ducked. She and the others were too exposed on the balcony, but where could they go? The waters roaring up the side of the tower promised only a quick death by drowning. She took potshots back at the boat. Then an antediluvian monster blasted out of the sea and rammed into the edge of the speedboat. The force cracked the hull and flipped the boat, tossing the crew out of their seats. Nearby, the monster settled to its carbon fiber keel, resting on the water. It was the yellow jet boat. Gray popped up beside it. He had his Sig Sauer in hand and fired at the floundering men, hitting three of them. The fourth already floated face down. Nearby, the cracked hull of the speedboat flooded and sank into the depths. "Gray!" Seishan shouted and waved an arm. He turned to face her, just as a second speedboat flew around the tower to the left, drawn by the gunfire. It raced under the balcony, spraying machine gun fire up at it. They all flattened, but Seishan knew they weren't the assault's true target. The patrol was only knocking them back to pass beneath them and go after easier prey.
"Move it, Gray."
4:37 a.m. Gray hauled himself over the side of the jet boat and sprawled flat on the deck, making himself a harder target. The second speedboat came shooting around the curve of the barge body. Gunfire shattered the marble off the balcony facade. His teammates ducked away, except for one. As the boat sailed under the sinking balcony, a sleek shape vaulted into view, back paws kicking off the railing for extra distance. Kane flew across the short gap and landed in the midst of the four patrolmen. The effect was the same as if a grenade had been tossed into the boat. One man flung himself overboard in fright and got chewed up by the frothing riptide of the sinking tower. Kane latched onto the throat of another. The driver screamed, yanked the wheel, and in a panic, drove the boat at full speed into an uprooted floating palm tree. The boat hit the thick trunk, shot into the air, and flipped upside down before crashing hard into the water. Bodies floated up seconds later, lifeless or unconscious. The only survivor proved his skill at dog paddling. Before that deadly collision, a sharp whistle from Tucker had sent Kane leaping from the boat, tail high. The dog landed safely in the calmer water, but the currents were pulling him back toward the churning tide at the base of the tower. Kane fought against it, burdened by his vest. No, you don't. Gray lunged into the captain's chair of the jet boat. He searched and found the key in the glove box and started the ignition. He feared the depths might have damaged the engine, but he also knew jet boats were built for such abuse. As he hoped, a choking burble, a spat of water from the stern jets, and the engine roared lustily. He shifted the throttle and shot toward where Kane struggled. Hang on! Sliding next to the dog, Gray lunged out and grabbed Kane by his waterproof vest. He struggled to get the sodden 60-pound dog into the boat. Recognizing it would take both arms, he let go of the wheel. Unpiloted, the craft got pulled closer to the tower. The churning water growled hungrily, the undertow sucking everything down. Finally, with a heave of his body, he hauled Kane aboard. The shepherd shook his heavy pelt, tail wagging, and bumped him affectionately. Thanks, Tucker called over to Gray.
Hey, what about us? Kowalski complained.
By now, water flooded the lower deck of their balcony, churning hungrily. His three teammates clung to the railing. Gray manned the wheel again, opened the throttle, and gunned his way over to the balcony. He brought the boat alongside them and worked the throttle to hold the craft steady. They climbed over the balcony and dropped on board. Tucker helped Kowalski with Amanda. She stirred enough to lift an arm and swat at the bigger of the two. Kowalski pushed her arm down.
Sheesh. That's the thanks I get for hauling your butt up 10 flights of stairs.
With everyone settled, Gray swung away from the sinking tower. The jet boat was only a 4-seater. With 6 on board, counting Kane, the boat drafted deeper than it should, making it sluggish and slow. But they were afloat. The same couldn't be said for Utopia. The current shifted under the boat, drafting the craft strongly to port. Gray corrected against that pull. But it only grew worse.
What the hell?
Pierce!
Kowalski hollered, drawing his attention away from the currents to the skies above. He craned his neck in shock. The tower of Borjabadi leaned precariously over the boat. Gray searched outward. Across the rest of the island, towers and spires all canted in the same direction, as if blown over by a stiff wind.
Oh, hell.
Seishan recognized the danger, too.
The island is tipping.
Gray jammed the throttle forward, picturing the island capsizing. They needed to get to open water. Off in the distance, a spire broke from its foundation. It toppled and slowly crashed into a neighboring building. Closer at hand, a mighty moan vibrated through the waters. It was the deep groan of concrete and steel under stress. No one doubted the source. All eyes turned to the Borjabadi. 4:40 a.m. It seemed the Eternal Tower wasn't living up to its name. Aboard a large patrol boat, Edward bore witness to the island's slow destruction. A quarter mile away, Utopia upended, breaking apart, sliding back into the sea, a modern Atlantis. At its center, the Borjabadi toppled, the upper levels breaking and sliding off the central axis like plates toppling from a tall stack. Word had reached him that the patrols sent to the tower had gone missing. Attempts to raise them on the radio had failed. It had to be the work of the group that attacked the base. Measures would have to be taken, but not without guidance. Petra stepped through a nearby hatch, carrying a satellite phone in her hand. Her eyes locked with his, warning him it wasn't good news. She held out the phone. He lifted it to his ear and heard the computerized voice greet him.
Is the child secured?
Yes.
And the mother?
Dead. Surely she had to be.
Then coordinate all forces on site. Establish a noose around that island. Hunt for those who assaulted the station.
And if they're found? He was given very specific instructions, ending with,
Petra will take matters in hand from there. She knows what is needed.
He swallowed hard, feeling demoted, but he dared not complain. And in the end, maybe it was better not to know. Chapter 31. July 3rd, 4:44 a.m., Gulf Standard Time, off the coast of Dubai. Gray raced the jet boat as the island tore itself apart around him. The sinking platform, twisted by tidal currents and punched from below by partially intact pylons, broke into smaller sections. Suddenly unmoored and top-heavy, those pieces began to topple and capsize, dropping buildings, spires, and scaffolding all around them. Gray tried to avoid the worst of that roiling grist mill, flying at full throttle. Still more towers fell. Walls tore apart with explosive retorts. Windows shattered in showering bursts. Floating debris choked their path, growing more treacherous by the minute. Gray jigged and jagged his way through the worst of it. The boat's resilient carbon fiber hull took care of the rest. He needed a way out to open water, but rubble and ruin seemed to block him at every turn.
Gray!
Seishan clutched harder to a brace.
I see it!
Ahead, a huge cross-section of a spire under construction, nothing more than a frame of iron, broke loose, hit a condominium tower, then rolled in their direction. Like some coin in a pachinko machine, it bounced and crashed toward them. Kowalski swore coarsely, a sentiment shared by all. There was no way past it, and Gray had only seconds to act. He sought the only cover available, but it would be tight.
Everyone duck!
He swung the jet boat to the right, spun the craft 180 degrees, and slammed it sideways under the protruding upper-story balcony of a sunken building. The tumbling monstrosity of iron clattered over them, then bounced away.
Nice job, parallel parking, Kowalski commented.
With a blast of the jets, Gray blew the boat back out of the shelter. He turned, dug in, and sped for the distant glimmer of open water. But even that path was closing. Ahead, two residential towers leaned drunkenly against each other. The one to the right crumbled against its partner, dropping slowly, raining broken glass and debris.
Go for it, Seishan said.
Gray had no choice. He gunned the engine, firing the jets behind him into a roar. The boat blasted away like a rocket, striving to duck under that lowering guillotine of steel, concrete, and glass. Kowalski curled over Amanda, whom he cradled on his lap.
I can't watch.
Seishan reached over and gripped Gray's forearm. Tucker braced his legs against the back of the captain's seat. Only one crew member had a different assessment. Kane came forward, tucked under Seishan's arm, and jumped up to bring his nose into the wind. His tail wagged fiercely, striking Gray in the shoulder. With that bit of encouragement, Gray tightened his fingers on the wheel. The jet boat screamed across the last of the water, skimming along the surface at over 60 miles an hour. Ahead, the building fell faster, the path below it pinching closed. But Gray was already committed.
Down, he yelled.
Seishan's fingers dug hard as she ducked, keeping Kane pinned under her arm. The jet boat reached the gap and shot under the toppling tower, shattering through a rain of falling glass. For several seconds, the world filled with the scream of tortured steel and the thundering grind of concrete. It felt like a derailed freight train tumbled past overhead. Then they burst clear. As the tower crashed into the sea behind them, casting up a huge wave that shoved them, along with a flotilla of debris, farther out into the dark waters. But those waters weren't entirely dark. A cordon of lights blocked the seas 300 yards out, including a yacht-sized cutter. The island's security fleet had set up a blockade. Gray slowed their flight.
Maybe they didn't see us, Sishan said.
Gray glanced doubtfully back. As he turned his attention forward, his fears were confirmed. A trio of those lights broke away, coming toward them. He spun the jet boat and raced in the opposite direction. More lights hovered out there, too, other vessels in the blockade. But that wasn't his goal. Once he gained some distance, he swung behind a floating pallet of construction lumber.
Don't think hiding here is going to work, Kowalski said.
Gray stood and pointed overboard.
Everybody out!
Sishan grabbed his arm.
What are you thinking? We can outrun them.
Not weighted down like this, Gray said, speaking fast.
He pointed to the fuel gauge.
Almost out of fuel. Don't have enough to make it to the mainland.
Then what are you going?
Sishan looked harder at him.
You're going to lead them off.
It's the best chance for Amanda. I dump you here, run off, and get them to chase me for as long as possible.
He pointed to Kowalski.
You've got Jack Kirkland's homing device. Maybe he survived and can reach you. If not...
Kowalski eyed the stack of lumber.
I'll build a boat.
Do your best, he said.
The others quickly shed boots and outerwear. Tucker stripped the vest off of Kane so his partner wasn't weighted down. They left Amanda in her hospital gown. She had begun to shake off the anesthesia, but she remained in a dull haze. Gray feared she was edging toward shock. He hated to leave her floating in the sea, but what other recourse did he have? He helped Tucker and Kowalski get her overboard. At least the surface waters were temperate as compared to down deep.
Keep her head elevated, Gray warned.
Kane splashed in next to them. He turned to Sishan. She remained fully clothed, with her arms crossed.
You're not coming with me, he said, guessing her intent.
I am.
We're not both going to sacrifice ourselves.
She frowned and looked him over as if he were crazy.
Who said anything about sacrificing myself? You want a distraction, something to keep those boats from poking their noses over here.
She pointed beyond the lumber pile.
See that big boat, the patrol cutter?
Yeah.
Time to turn the tables.
She lifted an eyebrow.
It's high time we played pirate.
4:58 a.m. Tucker could no longer hear the whine of the jet boat. He had watched the initial chase, saw them tear off to the side, leading the trio in a wild pursuit, running along the edge of the blockade. He hoped their plan worked, but he had his own mission to address, to keep Amanda safe. After pulling her off that surgical table, he felt extra responsible for her, especially as he'd abandoned her newborn in the rush to escape. I should have been more thorough in examining her. But there was nothing to be done to correct that mistake, except keep Amanda protected. To that end, he swam out toward where a plastic trash barrel floated on its side. He grabbed the handle. The plan was to build a nest around their hiding spot to do their best to camouflage themselves amid the debris field. Off to the east, the skies were already growing pale with the coming sunrise. He wanted better cover before then. He didn't expect they would have to remain in hiding for long, maybe 2 hours. A disaster of this scope, the sinking of an entire island, would draw a global media circus. Scores of television helicopters, curiosity seekers, and news reporters. Only then would it be safe to move Amanda out of hiding and search for a rescue, something to be caught on film. That exposure should keep Amanda safe. Such a story would attract a large audience. Nothing like blood in the water to draw attention. As he turned and dragged the barrel, a fin rose out of the water ahead of him. Then another. And another. He forgot that blood drew more than just attention. He pictured the hammerheads he'd seen earlier. Something bumped his leg. He let go of the barrel and yanked out his dagger. He'd left his pistol tucked in the stack of lumber. He searched, twisting all around, but the waters were pitch dark. Even the fins had vanished. Then something touched his ankle.
He kicked, striking something hard. It rose up under him, shoving him high. Seconds later, black water sluiced off the glass deck of the Ghost. The hatch popped open, and Jack Kirkland poked his head out. He eyed the dagger still in Tucker's fist.
You planning on attacking my boat with that poker? After all I went through to save your sorry asses?
Tucker sheathed his blade, wanting to hug the man. You try swimming through a crumbling forest of concrete with an island falling on top of your head. Jack wore a huge smile.
Was the time of my life. Now let's see about getting you all on board.
By the time that was accomplished, Jack had turned more somber, especially seeing Amanda's condition. She was shivering, blue-lipped and pale, on the edge of shock. Kowalski wrapped a dry blanket around her from the stores aboard the Ghost. He was surprisingly gentle for such a lumbering fellow. But a blanket was far from enough. She needs immediate medical help, Tucker said as he settled her into one of the seats. Kane sat next to him, leaning against his knee.
I know where she can get it, Jack said. Close by, I've got a state-of-the-art facility aboard the Deep Fathom. We can be steaming out of these waters within the hour and get her somewhere safe.
Tucker sank into his seat, grateful and relieved. Jack lowered the Ghost back under the water and piloted them away.
What the hell did they do to her?
I don't know, Tucker said numbly. And I hope I never do.
What about your other friends?
Tucker looked up through the glass roof and admitted the same.
I don't know.
5:01 a.m.
We're on fumes,
Gray shouted. At least I hope I have even that. Seishan sat next to him with her two cigs on her lap. She glanced over at him. A glimmer of fear shone in her eyes. She wasn't stupid, but it seemed only to ignite the larger excitement found there. She smiled, her hair whipped by the wind, the collar of her blouse snapping, showing the length of her neck.
Let's do this!
Ever a woman of few words. He grinned back, which only made her smile deepen. Still hard-edged and purposeful, but now shining with something darker and softer. Something he wanted to explore. When they had the time. He spun the jet boat back toward the blockade. They'd given the trio of pursuers a wild ride, weaving in and out of the line. The carbon fiber hull had a few new holes in it, but Seishan had shot the same number of men. She had proved her marksmanship hadn't dulled since he first met her. Of course, back then, she'd been an assassin for the Guild, shooting at him. Gray aimed their jet boat for the larger patrol cutter, 100-footer, plainly the command center for the fleet. He was confident that no eyes were looking toward where he'd hidden the others. He had planned on coming out here alone, expected to be captured. Maybe killed. And that hadn't changed. Only Seishan had offered another plan, to gain something from their sacrifice. This entire mission had started from an act of piracy. Perhaps another act of piracy could end it. Half of piracy involved bloodshed and destruction. From the sinking of the island, from the trail of bodies, they'd already accomplished that well enough. The other half of piracy was the theft of treasures. This is what they'd come to do. Gray raced toward the patrol cutter, heading dead on, a move the smaller ships hadn't expected. Caught off guard by the sudden suicidal move, the smaller boats were slow in closing the gap. Seishan further discouraged them. She stood, one knee on her seat for balance, her two arms raised out to either side, black cigs in each hand. She laid down a deadly barrage of fire to hold that gap open long enough for Gray to slip past their line of defense. Nothing stood between them and the lead ship of the fleet. It was a fast-response class cutter, typically holding a crew of 20, painted stark white. And like most modern patrol vessels, it featured a stern launch and recovery ramp made for deploying pursuit boats, even while underway. That was their target. The ramp was currently empty, as the entire fleet had been called to duty to build the blockade around the island. Gray aimed for that ramp with the last of his fuel and opened the throttle. Crew members ran to the stern of the ship, flanking the ramp. Automatic weapons pointed. On deck, a 25mm stabilized caliber gun mount swung toward them. Additionally, a patrol guard manned the round black disc of an LRAD, long-range acoustic device used as a sonic non-lethal shield against pirates, a useful tool in these waters. There was no way to assault that ship. They had only one choice.
Ready? He asked.
I'm out of bullets anyway, Seishan said.
Gray throttled down, killing the engines, then stood up, joining her. He laced his fingers atop his head. She made a broad display of tossing her pistols overboard, then took the same position, hands on head.
We surrender, he called out.
The jet boat's momentum carried them to the stern ramp and nosed them halfway up. Weapons tracked them on both sides. A commotion followed. The captain of the boat appeared at the top of the ramp. His dark features and heavy shadow of beard marked his Arab heritage. He was flanked by a thin, mustached man and a hard-muscled woman with an equally stern blonde bob.
On your knees, the captain said, pointing a pistol.
They obeyed. The captain barked an order in Arabic. Four men came racing down the ramp and dragged the boat the rest of the way up, then tied the craft in place, ensuring they didn't try to flee. Another two boarded and pulled their arms down, cuffing them behind them. Only then did the captain and the others come forward. The thin man approached on Seishan's side of the vessel, commenting in a stiff British accent.
She would be a perfect research subject, don't you think, Petra?
The blonde crossed over to Gray.
Careful, Dr. Blake. That one's not for you. At least not yet.
Petra leaned toward Gray.
Or this one. We thought hunting you or one of your colleagues would be harder. That makes me suspicious.
She lunged a hand at his neck, fast enough to catch his throat. He reflexively tried to pull away. A ghost of a smile appeared, amused by the surprise in his expression. Her other hand moved equally swift. A needle jabbed into his throat. A burn, like acid, spread as she pushed the plunger. He coughed at the intense pain. Petra straightened.
No, we have special plans for this one.
What plans? Blake asked. But his question had a faltering tone, as if he didn't want to know the answer.
He's a skilled sniper, Petra began.
Gray fought to listen, but the acid burned through his consciousness. The world constricted. Her voice drifted back down a long tunnel.
40 hours from now.
Her final words trailed to a whisper as he slumped to his side, sprawling next to Seishan. His vision narrowed to a pinpoint. Through that tiny hole, he watched Seishan shift her knee, switching off the camera attached to Kane's abandoned vest, hiding the fact that she had been recording the conversation before the others grew any wiser. He prayed someone was listening. Someone had to be listening. This was the pirate bounty they'd risked so much to steal. The most valuable treasure in the world. Information. As Gray faded to black, those last disturbing words followed him into oblivion.
40 hours from now, this man will assassinate the President of the United States.
Third, Hunting Grounds. Chapter 32. July 3rd, 1:04 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. Painter waited for the storm. He stood in the central hall that cut through the lowermost level of their command bunker. Here, Sigma hid its deepest secrets. He stood outside a room that only a handful of people had entered in the past 5 hours. His muscles knotted as he kept his post. He wanted to pace away his anxiety, needed to pace. It had been almost a day since he heard any word concerning Kat and Lisa, and even then, it had only been some grainy footage caught on a bank ATM camera. Not a word or sighting since. It ate a hole through his gut, through his spirit. But he had a duty that couldn't be forsaken.
At the end of the hall, the elevator chimed and opened. The first two people to exit were members of the Secret Service. They both eyeballed Painter. One came down the hallway, the other remained behind and waved President James Gant out of the elevator. Two more agents followed behind. General Metcalf accompanied the president.
This way, sir.
Gant's gaze locked onto Painter. A black cloud darkened his aspect, the fury in his eyes, the flush on his face, the hardness to his every move. Even his stride was angry. Painter hoped he could get a word out before getting punched, and he wasn't entirely sure he wouldn't still be slugged afterward. But the risk had to be taken. The fate of the country depended on the next few minutes. The press corps believed the president was attending a private meeting with the director of the Smithsonian. Even Gant thought he was here on Metcalf's behalf to listen to Painter give an impassioned plea to save Sigma from the axe. The president had only agreed to come here after intense backroom negotiations by Metcalf. The general had to call in many political chits to get these 5 minutes of the commander-in-chief's time. Gant checked his watch as he crossed those final steps. Apparently, time was already ticking down.
"This is a courtesy," Gant said,
his Carolina drawl thick with disdain.
"Because of General Metcalf's long, distinguished career. That's the only reason I'm here, and this is the last courtesy I will extend to you."
"Understood, Mr. President." Gant balled a fist.
"So speak your piece and let's be done with it."
Painter instead turned to Metcalf.
"What about the Secret Service agents?"
"Thoroughly vetted," Metcalf answered. "All four. You'll need them for what's to come."
Gant looked between the two of them.
"Need them for what?"
Painter stepped back.
"Before I speak, Mr. President, I need you to see something."
Turning, Painter crossed to the door behind him. One of the Secret Service agents followed him. Painter opened the way and let the man go inside first to inspect the room. When he came out, his face was paler.
"Clear,"
the agent stated, then stepped aside. Painter held the door and nodded to Gant. Glowering and straightening his tie, the president strode into the room. Painter followed, shadowed by another agent, while the others took posts in the hall. Gant stepped woodenly to the hospital bed. He stopped at the edge, his posture ramrod stiff. Then he collapsed to his knees, half falling across the mattress. His shoulders shook, then the sobs racked out of him. If Painter had any lingering doubts about the man's authenticity, they vanished in that moment.
"My baby," he cried. "She's alive."
Amanda Gant Bennett lay quietly on the bed, still under a light sedation. She wore a blue flowered hospital gown. Intravenous fluids, along with two antibiotics, ran into a central line. Equipment monitored oxygenation, heart rhythm, and blood pressure. She wore a cap over her head. Beneath that, a bandage covered the surgery site where the cranial drill had been expertly removed by a neurosurgeon. A drain remained in place due to the length of time the burr hole had been left open. CT scans had showed the drill had penetrated the superior sagittal sinus through the frontal bone, but the cerebral cortex remained untouched. Secondary trauma had resulted in a tiny subdural hematoma, but that appeared to be resolving on its own. With rest and time, she should fully recover. Two other people occupied the room: Amanda's neurosurgeon and Tucker Wayne. Neither man had left the young woman's side since she arrived 5 hours ago. Her path back to the States had been a circuitous one. Jack Kirkland had transported her to the Deep Fathom, where medical personnel on board his ship had stabilized her en route to Abu Dhabi. There, Painter had called on the assistance of someone he trusted, someone who had powerful influences in the area, the oil baroness, Lady Kara Kensington. She had arranged a private corporate jet while Painter prepared false papers. No one outside Painter's Circle knew Amanda still lived. Until now. Gant turned, staying on his knees.
How?
That one word encompassed so much. I'll need more than 5 minutes, Painter said. Once granted, Painter told him everything. He left nothing out, drawing Gant back to his feet with the story. They stepped into a neighboring medical office just off of the ward. The father refused to be more than a few steps away from his daughter. When he got to the story of Amanda's rescue, Gant shook Tucker's hand.
Thank you, son.
Tucker nodded. My honor, sir. I'd like to meet that dog of yours sometime. I'm sure that could be arranged. Painter had highlighted the key parts of Amanda's story. All that was left were questions he couldn't fully answer.
But I still don't understand, Gant said. Why did they want my grandson?
We're still trying to piece that together. Amanda had some moments of lucidity. I was able to ask her a few questions, glean some answers.
Tell me, Gant said.
He was seated at a small desk in the medical office, too shaken to keep his feet. Painter remained standing. Your daughter received a couriered package from an unknown source. Inside were fake passports and a note warning Amanda to flee, that her child was in danger. There were also papers included, medical documents, faxes, lab reports, enough to convince your daughter to vanish in order to protect her baby. The note also warned her not to tell anyone in her family, not to trust anyone.
But why?
Gant's expression was a mix of incredulity and fear. Anger lurked there, too, smoldering up toward a fierce fire. Someone wanted that child. I believe your grandson was the product of a genetic experiment, a global-wide research project that spanned decades, if not longer, one involving human trafficking and experimentation. The disbelief shone brighter.
What sort of experiment are you talking about?
I can't say for sure. Something to do with his DNA. That's what Amanda overheard. But based on other intelligence sources, I believe the research has something to do with the incorporation of an engineered protein into his genetic structure. He may be the first child where this was successful. Gant shook his head.
But what's their ultimate goal? What do they want with my grandson?
Painter saved the worst for last. Amanda believes they plan to experiment on your grandson. To keep him alive, or at least his tissues, to study him in more detail. Gant shoved to his feet. Horror ignited that smoldering fury.
What? How? Who the hell are these bastards?
As Painter prepared to answer that, a more pressing question weighed on his mind. Where are they? 1:42 p.m. Blue Ridge Mountains. The stethoscope lifted gently from the newborn's frail chest. The child's heart could be seen beating against that cage, thumping weakly. His skin shone with a slight cyanotic cast, indicating poor oxygenation. Dr. Edward Blake announced his verdict to Petra.
He's shutting down. Already underweight and premature, it could be a failure to thrive.
He shrugged.
Or the stress of the transportation here may have overwhelmed his systems.
Petra's disappointment showed in the heavy cast to her eyes, the sternness to her lips. She wasn't concerned for the child's welfare. They'd lost many others. But after all the troubles in Somalia and Dubai, they both needed a win here. And any hope of that faded with every passing breath of the child. The newborn rested inside a heated incubator, nestled in blankets. A nasal cannula supplied a steady stream of oxygen. A nasogastric tube allowed the administration of formula. Cuffs and pads monitored oxygenation, heart and respiratory rate, blood pressure, and temperature.
Edward shook his head. We may need to place him in a PICC and switch to CPAP for his shallow breathing.
or tube and ventilate him. He must find a way to stabilize this child. The last DNA sequencing showed significant PNA loss in the child. The triple helix complexes in his vital tissues were breaking down. But most troublesome of all, Edward still didn't know why. One possible explanation was that the child's body was simply rejecting the foreign protein making up that third helix. And as a consequence, the child grew sick, slowly shutting down. The other possibility was that the child was failing to thrive for ordinary reasons. He was too thin, too poorly developed, and that stress triggered a secondary metabolic breakdown of the triple helices. "Chicken or the egg?" he asked the baby. "Did the breakdown of the helix cause your body to weaken? Or did your weakened body cause the helix to break down?" More likely, it was a combination of the two, creating some sort of cascade effect. No matter which scenario was true, he and Petra were in trouble. Failure was not rewarded in this organization, and seldom tolerated. Edward stared around the small, windowless ward assigned to them in this guarded complex. Currently, these new facilities were ill-suited for their purposes. The work done at the lodge was primarily militaristic in nature, not like the wonders promised by the research at Utopia's labs. He looked around the square ward, his temporary refuge and workspace. Their evacuation and exodus from Utopia had been rushed and unexpected, leaving little time for any real preparations. Crates remained unboxed. An entire wing waited for the installation of a new genomics lab. No doubt, Edward could rebuild here, but it would take time. Time the child didn't have. He stared back at the incubator. En route from Dubai, it was evident the baby was destabilizing. Edward had ordered what he needed for emergency neonatal care and had it airlifted and delivered here. But as the child declined, he faced a sad reality. Getting equipment here was one matter, but finding skilled medical personnel who could be vetted and arrive in time was a challenge at this highly guarded facility. Especially following the swath of ruin left behind, both out in the Middle East and here in South Carolina. They'd lost several significant colleagues in both places. The wheels were already turning to bring staffing on site, but again, timing was critical. Performing even the simplest of the proposed procedures required a minimum number of skilled staff working around the clock. "We need extra hands," he concluded. "Capable, skilled hands. At this point, I'll take one additional person, if talented enough." Petra nodded, fully aware. "I'll make a call. We may have what we need already here." Dr. Lisa Cummings paced the length of her cell. She left her lunch untouched on the small tray, a turkey club, and a small bag of Doritos. There was something obscene about the ordinariness of the fare. She stared around her cell as she made another pass from front to back. The dull ache from her sprained ankle kept her focused. The walls were a seamless white plastic. The door was made of a hard glass polymer, framed in steel. She had pressed her cheek against that glass, trying to see as much as she could past her threshold. All she saw was a hall of similar cells, all appearing empty. Where is Kat? The worry ate at her and fueled her pacing. The cell had only a few accommodations, a cot with a foam mattress and a stainless steel commode with sink. The only luxury was a flat-screen television molded into the wall. But Lisa couldn't escape the feeling that someone was watching her through it. Or maybe it was just a paranoia born of the after-effects of the drugs. After they were caught last night by the helicopter, four uniformed men had skimmed down on lines from the cabin of the aircraft. They had tied Kat and Lisa up, then injected them intramuscularly with a sedative. She guessed from the stabbing ache in her eyes and the stiffness of her leg muscles that they'd given her some form of ketamine. She had regained a groggy consciousness at one point during the trip, enough to tell she was in the back of the Ford Explorer.
Cat lay sprawled next to her, eyes rolled back, snoring slightly. Lisa was too weak to move, but through the back window, she watched dark woods and tall cliffs roll past, suggesting they were in the mountains. She guessed the Blue Ridge Mountains, but she couldn't be certain. She had faded away again and suspected she had been given a second injection at some point. Two needle marks itched on her upper arm. She scratched absently at them through the thin gown she wore. Someone had stripped her and dressed her in a featureless cotton dress, like a hospital gown, but closed in the back. It was pulled over the head and cinched in place. She also wore slippers and an ill-fitting bra and pair of panties. The garments were clean, but not new. From the slight fraying, someone had worn these clothes before, and that added to her nervousness. What had happened to those others? A sharp buzz sounded from the television. It drew her attention around. On the screen, the view of a small hospital ward appeared. Two figures in scrubs moved across the screen, working in what appeared to be an NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit. A computer-altered voice spoke, eerily flat and disjointed. Dr. Lisa Cummings, it has come to our attention that you have both a medical background and a PhD in physiology. Is that correct? Yes, she said tentatively, not thinking of a good reason to lie. They clearly knew who she was, likely pulling her records based on her fingerprints. Usefulness is a virtue here, she was coldly instructed. Everyone must have a purpose. To that end, we would like you to assist us in diagnosing and treating a newborn here at the facility. We're currently understaffed for the work necessary, especially in regards to skilled medical personnel. Lisa digested this and came to one conclusion. Why should I help you? If saving the life of a child is not enough, perhaps the life of a friend. The view swiped away, and a room similar to hers materialized on the monitor, only its walls were a dark red. It was like looking through a window into a neighboring cell. But that room could be anywhere in the complex. The woman seated on the bed burst to her feet, rushed forward to fill the screen, placing a hand against it. Lisa laid hers there too, matching finger for finger. She imagined the warmth of the electronics came from the palm of her best friend. Cat! Lisa, are you okay? The connection cut, and the screen went black. The voice returned. Every failure or disobedience on your part will be exacted upon the flesh of your friend. Prove your usefulness, and you both continue to live. She swallowed hard, suddenly finding it too chilly in her thin gown. What do you want me to do? The electronic door lock clicked loudly. Go out to your right, end of the hall. The screen went dark. Lisa hesitated a few breaths, but she knew she had no choice. Cooperation would buy extra time. Time to find a way to escape. Time for Painter to find them. She pictured her boyfriend's face, the lock of snowy hair tucked behind one ear, the sharp intelligence in his eyes, and most of all, the love shining in the night across a pillow. That last, more than anything, gave her the strength to keep moving. She stepped over to the door, pushed it open, and headed to the right. The hall held a dozen cells. She searched for Cat among them, but they all appeared empty, at least as far as she could tell. Cat, she called out softly, walking slowly, swiveling her head. No response. No face appeared pressed against a glass door. Several of the rooms had their mattresses rolled up, giving the entire wing a feeling of disuse, but also a sense of expectation, like an empty boarding school waiting to be occupied for a new semester. Maybe that came from the low murmur of voices ahead. Reaching the end of the hall, she pushed through the far door into the small medical ward, the same one from the television. Crates and boxes filled one half of the space, some open, others spilling packing material and showing plastic-wrapped medical equipment inside. The other half held the neonatal unit. A woman in scrubs spotted her and motioned her forward to join them, like one colleague greeting another. Before she could step closer, a door on the other side of the ward opened, and a broad-shouldered older man entered, dressed in a somber gray suit, his white hair neatly combed, his manner genteel as he strode over to Lisa. She had become rooted in place, recognizing him. The man held out his hand, his Carolina drawl warm.
"Thank you, Dr. Cummings, for agreeing to help my grandnephew."
Lisa shook his hand, dumbfounded. He was the former ambassador to Southeast Asia turned Secretary of State, and brother to the president, Robert L. Gant. 1:55 p.m., Washington, D.C.
"Tell me," James Gant demanded, staring off to the next room, where his daughter rested on the hospital bed.
"Who's behind all of this?"
Painter knew the next part of this discussion would take some delicacy. What transpired here was for the president's ears and eyes only. Him and one other. Jason Carter worked at the desk computer in the medical office where Painter and the president had been holed up. His Secret Service agents continued to watch the hall, with one posted next to Amanda. Jason finally nodded, ready to proceed. He had the necessary footage transferred and keyed up. Painter faced Gant.
"As you know, Mr. President, we already suspected the Guild had a hand in the kidnapping of your daughter."
Gant's eyes darkened.
"I've read the intelligence briefings."
"Exactly. But the Guild is not their true name. It's more of an umbrella designation, encompassing the group's many cells around the world. A network of agents and operatives ensconced in various militaries, governments, research institutions, and financial circles. There are many levels within this organization. Some go by other names, but recently I've uncovered a clue to the true leaders, the puppet masters of the Guild." Gant focused harder on him.
"Go on."
"This inner circle has also hidden under many names, burying themselves in countless secret societies to cover their footprints, going back centuries."
"Centuries?"
A skeptical note rang in the man's voice. "At least to the Middle Ages," Painter confirmed. "Maybe even farther back into the past." He flicked a glance toward Jason. The young analyst was tracing the lineage of the Gant family deeper into history, but it was slow going, and that track grew fainter, worn away by time into mere rumor and suspicion.
"What about now?" Gant said, keeping his eye on the target. "What do you know about their operations today?"
"We know two things. First, we know they're tied to your family." Gant choked slightly.
"What?"
Painter forged on before he lost the man completely. "Second, we know the name most commonly associated with them is the Bloodline." Gant stirred at the mention of that word, plainly recognizing it. Painter wasn't surprised by his reaction. Amanda had known the name too, but he wanted to hear what the president had to say.
"Director, I respect you. I owe you a great debt of gratitude, but you're chasing ghosts. You've taken rumor and hearsay and added flesh and bone to it."
Painter remained silent, letting Gant have his say. The president continued.
"Suspicions plague most rich families. Rumors wrapped in conspiracies entwined in maniacal plots. Take your pick. The Kennedys, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Rothschilds. In the past, each one of them has been tied to secret societies and global machinations, and we're no exception. Go ahead and pluck any card out of that conspiracy deck. Freemasonry, the Trilateral Commission, Skull and Bones, the Bilderberg Group, and you'll find some story connecting them to our family."
Gant shook his head, plainly disappointed.
"That name. Bloodline. That's our family's personal boogeyman, made to scare children into obeying. Stories about a family within our family. It's not supposed to be mentioned beyond our doors. Growing up, I heard all sorts of tales, mostly spoken under bed covers at night, of people who mentioned that name too loudly, only to suddenly disappear. I'm sure they did, Painter thought. Likely killed or recruited into the fold. You've been hoodwinked, Director. Sold a bill of goods if you've fallen into that conspiratorial trap. Painter felt the wind dying in the man's sails, knowing now was the time. He nodded to Jason. Bring up the footage I asked you to prepare. He returned his attention to Gant. Amanda described a symbol painted on that tent cabin in Somalia. We found that same mark again closer to home, at the fertility clinic where she had her in vitro fertilization performed. Jason stepped back. On the monitor, Kat's footage began to play. It showed her again rushing up to a set of large steel doors. Pause it there, Painter said, fighting down a pang of worry for Kat and Lisa. The video stopped and focused squarely on the center of the door. A large embossing stood out plainly, a crimson cross with genetic code wrapped within it. Earlier, Amanda had recognized it, claiming it was a symbol tied to the bloodline. From Gant's flinch, he knew it too. He leaned closer, his voice hushed. Impossible. Painter motioned for Jason to continue the footage. This is what that symbol hid. Painter didn't watch the video. He didn't need to see that again. Instead, he studied the president's profile. The blood visibly drained from the man's face. His lips parted in a silent gasp of horror. Knowing he'd seen enough, Painter made a cutting motion across his own neck. Jason ended the playback, leaving the president stunned. It took a long minute for Gant to look away from the screen, to turn haunted eyes toward Painter. Behind that glassy numbness, Painter knew Gant pictured his own daughter. To his credit, the man nodded, accepting the truth. As he stood, his voice hardened to a vengeful edge. If you're right, if members of my own family perpetrated such atrocities, committed such cruelties upon my daughter, I want them hunted down. His anger focused on one question now. Where do we start? Before Painter could answer, another person must have heard Gant's rising anger and recognized it. Daddy? Everyone turned back to the hospital bed in the next room. The patient's eyes were open. She searched, blearily. Amanda! Gant rushed to her bedside, crashing to one knee to take her hand. Baby girl, I'm here! Amanda found her father's face, but rather than relief, a faint reflection of Gant's fury shone there. Her fingers tightened on her father's hand. She fought through the dregs of her sedation. He consoled his daughter. You're gonna be fine. Amanda wanted no such reassurances, only results. Daddy, they took William. They took my baby boy. You... Her fingers clutched until her knuckles paled. You get him back. The demand took the last of her strength. She stared into her father's face, exacting a promise from him.